Hi, I'm Karma Wong Ulrich, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of January 10th, 2014. So this show is about how to not only get more money out of all the choices you make in life, but more value. This week in How We Live Money, your credit card questions answered quickly, and getting back into investing after you've been burned. But first up, jobs. Only 74,000 new jobs were created in December, and that's the bleakest number we've seen in 3 years. Now, in this climate, we know that millions of us have felt the sting of job loss. One high-profile case recently, though, the writer Will Blythe, he was let go from the website Byliner, and he was offered a standard 2-week severance package. This was in exchange for signing a non-disparagement clause. Well, Blythe declined, and he wrote about it in the New York Times. Now, 2 weeks' pay can be vital to some folks. So what are your rights when you're let go? And what can you do to protect yourself without leaving any money on the table? David Yamada is a professor of law at Suffolk University in Boston. Welcome, David.
Hi, Carmen. It's great to be on the show.
You know, when I think about folks who are leaving a job or being laid off, 2 weeks severance can really be a big deal. So is this something that folks can do, what Will Blythe did, or is this just his experience?
Well, I think it is an individual question. Will Blythe was in a position to say, you know what, I'm not going to sign that non-disparagement clause in return for 2 week severance. But there might be others for whom that severance is very important. They might need that money. So there are trade-offs in terms of that decision.
Yeah. And how common, though, are these clauses? Because, you know, in his line of work, when you're talking about journalism, there's a lot of intellectual property stuff. How common, though, across the board in other industries are these clauses?
Carmen, these clauses are becoming very, very common in separation situations. And oftentimes it's under conditions very similar to what Will Blythe wrote about. Maybe there's an agreement not to contest an unemployment claim, or there's severance at stake. Conditions like that are very often attached to these non-disparagement clauses.
Does this have a lot to do, though, with social media? Because it seems like social media now has really become a megaphone for anybody and everybody.
Well, I think what you've seen over the recent years is the internet becoming that megaphone that you mentioned. You've got sites like eBoss Watch and Glassdoor and general sites such as YouTube and Yelp, where people are posting about their workplace experiences, sometimes good, sometimes bad, and at times very critical and on occasion hyperbolic. So I think there is some legitimate concern on the part of employers in terms of what former employees will say about them. I think there are some good and bad things, though, about these non-disparagement clauses as a general policy.
Yeah, you mentioned the good and bad, because I think a lot of folks don't read these agreements line by line. But it really is, do you think, in people's best interest to do so?
Well, they may not have much of a choice, right? Mm. At the time they're being terminated, they might have that severance on the table. They might have a request for unemployment benefits about to be filed. I think there are some things that people can do. For example, they could ask in return for signing that non-disparagement clause for a positive reference. Because for someone who's just lost their job, not only are they looking at replacing that missing income, but even more importantly is the opportunity to get new employment. And that positive reference could be a difference maker for them in the future. So there are more things that possibly somebody in that position could bring to the table.
There was another report that was just released by Pew Research. It's called Why It's Great to Be the Boss. And It shows really how bosses are more satisfied with their family life, their current job, their financial situation. So, you know, as we talk about inequality and all of this, it seems that they have the power to say, don't do something, here's some money. And employees tend to not feel like they have much power. But you bring up a point that they can ask for something in return.
Yes. But it is a more one-sided power relationship. Every year, the Gallup organization does a public opinion survey on worker satisfaction. And consistently, over the last 10 or 15 years, Roughly 65 to 70% of respondents say that they don't feel connected or engaged with their workplace. So that's a constant figure that transcends the recession and the ups and downs of the economy. And in addition, you've got a lot of people feeling bullied and disrespected at the workplace. And unless you are a manager, you most likely don't have a lot of power to challenge those types of behaviors, especially for the vast majority of employees in the U.S. who are not members of labor unions.
David Yamada is professor of law and director of the New Workplace Institute at Suffolk University in Boston. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Carmen, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Well, this new economy means that it's really normal to have several different jobs throughout our careers and throughout our life, which can mean several different retirement accounts.
Carmen.
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 Carmen, what's going on?
Oh, well, it's that time. It's time for our first listener call. We've got Dawn who joins us from Albany, New York. She's got a question about those multiple retirement accounts. Dawn, talk to us.
Oh, I'd love to. I just celebrated my 50th birthday, and this prompted me to think about retirement plans seriously. I'm single, and actually, I have been saving for a while. I have 401k and a 403b, and they scattered all over. The total amount is roughly 200,000. I also have roughly 200,000 in mutual funds and the savings. I went to my banks, and then they suggested I consolidate all the funds and hire a professional to manage my finance. But the downside is the fee. And given the situation I have now, I don't really have a steady income. I kind of hesitate to do that.
Now, in terms of those investments and where they are they all in individual retirement accounts, or are these brokerage accounts that are not IRAs?
Half of it is individual retirement funds. They are in Fidelity, Vanguard, TIAA.
Now, you said that you're not full-time working right now?
I am a consultant, so I get my engagements, but not, you know, every month. That's kind of a scary situation.
Well, it's definitely a little bit more precarious, but there's also a lot more potential, possibly, for you to do really well. With those retirement accounts, 2% is a tremendous amount of money, especially for the fact that you're 50. Happy birthday, by the way.
Thank you.
That's an awesome number to hit. And the thing is, though, that you're really closer to retirement, so you have to be careful about stuff like those fees. They can drastically cut what you are going to have. What I love for you to do, Dawn, is I know your accounts are scattered. Can you contribute to any of them?
I can. I really need to be disciplined.
Right. So you want some guidance, because one of the points I want to make is that even though you have multiple retirement accounts, you know, there is an advantage to rolling some of them over, rolling them into each other. What that depends on is what are your options and investment options. Now, you have accounts with the big guys, so you have tons of investment options and their fees are pretty low. So it's more about, does this make sense to pull them all together? You could roll them into each other if they're similar. However, if they are different, one's a 403b, one's a 401k, one's a traditional IRA, for tax reasons, you may want to keep them where they are. But you said you need discipline and you need guidance. Somebody to help you bundle all that stuff for two reasons. One, to get the best tax advantages, and two, to make sure that you are choosing the right assets, where to put your money based on your retirement plans. Here's what you can do. Get a fee-based financial planner who works hourly. And this is a secret, and it shouldn't be a secret, that a lot of financial planners who are fee-based do work hourly. So instead of you handing your money over to somebody where they shave a bit off the top of all of it, you have somebody who just sits with you, looks over where all your accounts are, and gives you a detailed what to-do list. And that's somebody who can really help you for an hourly fee, which is certainly a lot less than compounding 2%.
year after year after year.
What's a typical or standard fee for a financial planner?
For an hourly planner, it really ranges all over the country. I know you're in Albany. It could be anything from $150 to up. I mean, the most I would say is probably 500 plus. Some hourly planners can charge you a flat fee to build you a plan, which gives you step-by-step directions or to help you implement the plan. But in the short term, that can be so valuable because somebody can take a look at all of your papers and see something. Did you know that you could save this much money by just doing this? And I'll tell you how to find one near you. I mean, you can ask around, of course. FPANet.org. That's the site of the Financial Planning Association. And right there, smack in the middle of the site, it says find a planner near you. And also, don't forget something. These people work for you.
Okay.
You need to interview them and background check them. So you go to sec.gov. That's the site of the Security Exchange Commission. And check out their track record. Make sure they have, you know, no legal issues. And interview a couple of them who deal specifically, Dawn, with folks like you who aren't on a regular paycheck.
I think I'm learning all these aspects of managing money, which is not my strong suit.
Dawn, I'm telling you, don't belittle yourself now. You are brilliant right now at this. Here's my checklist for you, Dawn. So when we get off, here's what I'd love for you to do. First, make sure you've got all of your statements from where your money is. Look online at fpanet.org, find a fee-based hourly planner, and I'm sure that the financial planner will give you other assignments as to learning more about how to invest in those assets, because you're in pretty good shape. But all you need now is someone to just hold your hand, not take all your money, but hold your hand and give you a strategy to get you to where you want to be.
Thank you so much.
You can find some of those websites at marketplacemoney.org. Coming up, a fresh start.
It's a problem when people early in life have a bad investment experience. We've seen this happen in the past, and we refer to this as snake bite. You have a bad experience, and then you never go back and do it again.
Have no fear. The answers are here. Next on Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Carmen Wong-Ulrich. Yeah, so the markets had a blockbuster year in 2013, but that doesn't mean that 2014 is going to be all gravy.
Carmen, what's going on?
Well, what's going on is we've invited Greg Fisher to join us to help answer your questions. He is the Chief Investment Officer at Gerstein Fisher. It's an independent investment management and advisory firm. Greg, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Carmen. It's great to be here.
Well, and you know, Greg, before we get to folks' questions, I have to address this because it was really such a record year in terms of earnings in the market. S&P down way, way, way up in 2013. But we know that folks' wealth didn't necessarily reflect the same numbers. What's this going to look like going forward?
In one regard, the fact that the market has risen 10,000 points since the bottom of the market when we were together a few years ago.
Right.
It's astronomical. But should that actually influence the future returns? In theory, yesterday's prices should have nothing to do with the price of the market. Actually, investors should pay no attention at all to what happened yesterday. Those things should not be influencing future returns. But we do know that that's not reality. Reality is, we all can't help ourselves. The other thing is to just think about your time horizon, of course. If you're to be invested over the next 10, 15, 20, 30 years, someone who might be 30 years old planning for retirement, someone who's in their 50s thinking about a 30, 40-year life expectancy, the reality is what happens to the market in the next 6 months to 3 years is probably not that relevant. So my opinion would be people should get invested, have a strategy, stay invested, and not worry about what happened yesterday.
Let's go to Matthew. Matthew's got a question. He's from Bethesda, Maryland. He's in his 20s. Matthew had some fun with the stock market because he's a really great saver, but he got burned badly. Matthew, welcome.
Hi, it's great to be here.
All right, Matthew, so talk to us. What happened?
My personal finances, I've been kind of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. So I've been able to really cut my expenses and save significantly every month and kind of get this nice nest egg together that I have currently. But unfortunately, the other side of that is I started to invest in equities markets and especially some more risky plays like options and biotech stocks. So in a year when the S&P went up about 30%, I lost significant, you know, in the thousands of dollars. Needless to say, I've kind of abandoned that strategy, luckily, but now I'm kind of very hesitant to get back into the market. And really, most of my money is in short-term or longer-term CDs right now, earning just a shade over 1.5% interest. So I'm really wondering, you know, what I should be doing with my money. I'm still pretty young, and how do I overcome this fear of putting money in the market and seeing it instantly drop in value?
Well, Matthew, I have to ask you one thing. Well, first of all, just to clarify, I want to let folks know, you, my friend, are one of the few 20-somethings with no debt. You actually have a net worth. You have a lot of money saved. But I got to ask you, in terms of investing, you chose probably the riskiest way outside of like penny stocks to invest. Why did you want to go into options? Was this just about making the money? What was it about?
I'm not sure. I think part of it was, you know, other people can do this. Why can't I? And, you know, it's not like I just went in, you know, without any background information. I did my research and things like that. But then I realized that really the up and downs of the market kind of played with my emotions too much. And I always seemed to sell at the worst possible time or buy at the worst possible time. And I guess the reason I got into it initially is that I'm really trying to save enough money to get a down payment for a house or a condo in the DC area. I've saved a lot. Getting that down payment amount or that 20% is a difficult thing to do with house prices the way they are.
Wait, Matthew, so this is pretty short-term money. This is not necessarily retirement money that you're looking to put away and invest.
I have about $40,000 now in retirement-only accounts.
Okay.
So this was, you know, some of my short-term cash that I was trading with so unsuccessfully.
Greg, Matthew's giving you a ton to chew on here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go at it.
Hey, Matthew, it's nice to meet you here. The one thing I'd caution you is that it's a problem when people early in life have a bad investment experience. We've seen this happen in the past, and we refer to this as snake bite. You have a bad experience, and then you never go back and do it again. I wouldn't underestimate how those early bad experiences could influence your future choices, and that is not a healthy thing. Try to erase them from your memory. But looking forward, the idea of saving for a home with your non-retirement funds, I would think it would make sense for you to keep those funds invested conservatively. Maybe CDs or bonds or cash. If your plan is to buy this home in the next 3 to 5 years, maybe less than that, if that's the objective, in my opinion, those funds should be invested conservatively, and I would stay out of the equity markets with that money, and I certainly wouldn't be thinking of insurance strategies like options. You should invest in things that have a positive expected return and things that are liquid and not so volatile with those funds. On the other hand, your retirement funds that you mentioned, that is probably where I would suggest, given your phase of life and your objectives, I'd be 100% in the equity markets there. These are funds that you're not going to need for a long time. You probably have got 30 years or more on that money before you're going to be looking at it. And there, the volatility in the markets really shouldn't change your life in any way. So my thoughts would be to have a strategy with your retirement accounts that are very aggressive. What I would not do is to go out and try to pick the raindrop that hits the bottom of the window first. You know, this idea of picking the right stock or the right sector. You should be very diversified, probably globally invested. But in those funds, I'd continue an aggressive investment strategy.
You know, Matthew, one thing that encouraged me about you is because I do encounter so many 20-somethings, and a lot of the research shows that millennials are actually terrified of investing because they saw what happened with the recession in the market. So, but Matthew, you personally experienced a huge loss. However, I'm very encouraged by the fact that you had the impetus to kind of go and research something, and it's money that you could afford, and I put that in little air quotes, to lose. But Matthew, there's like a middle ground, right, Greg? I mean, is there, with his retirement, for example, he went options and biotech, really like sector specific and complicated, that he can be a part of the market and the earnings in the market without exposing himself to so much risk.
Typically in 401k retirement plans, you know, there are diversified mutual fund options available where you could have a piece of virtually every security in the world, global baskets of securities, possibly some form of, you know, index or market-based investments where, you know, with a small amount of capital, you could be invested in thousands of securities across, you know, 36 countries. And in the end, the bet there is that over time, capitalism works and that over time, markets earn a return.
Are you comfortable with having diversification in your retirement, which means that that's going to be in the market, but it's going to be spread around, so it spreads around your risk, but that your cash savings and saving for this home, it's really not going to earn a lot because you can't risk it?
Yeah, and I think that's something that I just have to learn to accept. You know, talking about that snake bite syndrome, I think that applies perfectly to me. You know, I think a diversified strategy, you know, kind of one of those gone fishing portfolios where you just kind of set it and forget it would be the most appropriate thing to do for my retirement portfolio. And then I just have to accept the fact that, you know, I'm not going to be earning a high yield on my short-term cash, and that's okay.
Well, Matthew, think about this in terms of, you know, being able to sit on your hands a little bit. Think about the fact of why would do you expose your money to risk? So, for example, Greg, you know, with the cash, why expose it to risk if you need that money in the short term, but his retirement is so far ahead that that's okay?
Yeah, I think that's a real good point. You want to think about your portfolio as a portfolio as compared to competition across the constituent parts. So, for example, if you had half your portfolio earning 1%, but if the other half of the portfolio earned 10%, well, 50% at 1 and 50% at 6, you're still going to earn 5.5% on the total. And that's a reasonable objective with a portfolio like that.
Yeah, it's what's the money for. So if it's for something that you need that cash and you need it fairly soon, then it's okay that it's not earning. Because I say to folks a lot of times, especially like, let's say, with emergency savings, that, oh, it's not earning anything. Well, it's insurance.
Absolutely.
Right? Or for you, Matthew, it's building literally a foundation to own a home. So that's money that you don't want to lose, for sure. Matthew, what do you think? Do you think you can sit on your hands for a bit?
Absolutely. I think I've learned a lot of lessons over the past year or so. And you know, this is really helpful and confirms a lot of the thoughts I've been having as to the direction I should take.
Wonderful, Matthew. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Thank you so much.
Speaking of emergency funds, Greg, we have an email from Robin in LA, and she hears a lot about emergency funds. What constitutes an emergency? What needs to go down for me to actually use that money? Also, 6 months versus 8 months, where do these numbers come from? Greg, I'll quickly tackle the top. What's an emergency? You lose your job. You lose your income. That's the big emergency. But Greg, speak a bit about the amount. How much? How do we plan for that?
So I think this is obviously a number that you have to address it in two ways. One is maybe there's some methodology or calculation depending on your specific situation. And then the other is a behavioral issue. From a financial perspective, I think good practice is for people to have somewhere between 6 months and 2 years worth of their living expenses in cash. If you have a high volatile job, a job that may not be one that you feel secure could last, if your income is sort of sporadic, I think a larger emergency fund might make sense. There isn't necessarily a right answer, but the key thing is to have enough in cash so that under most scenarios you could imagine that are possibly negative, that you're never forced to sell your long-term investments at a bad time. You don't want to be selling your stock market investments when the market's down 50% to produce the income you need to live on. So having 2 years' worth of your living expenses in cash during the financial crisis, so that all the income you needed to live on was coming from cash, all your stock market and bond market investments remained invested. Over a 2 or 3 year period, the recovery kicked in, and no one had to sell at a bad time. And that was a classic example of where retirees benefited from having, you know, 1 or 2 years worth of their living expenses in cash.
And you don't have to save it all tomorrow. This can be a very long-term proposition. Greg, stay with us now because we're going to answer another listener question after this break. It's a good one. How much should you plan on taking out each month after you retire? Greg Fisher joins us here with me to answer your questions. He's a CFP and the founder and chief investment officer of Gerstein Fisher. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Carmen. How are you?
Good, thanks. Let's get back to these phones. We got some great questions here. Our next caller is Nancy from San Francisco. Nancy, welcome.
Hi.
Hi. So, Nancy, you're a librarian.
Right.
And right now you have a pension and you have a mortgage, but you're looking to possibly move.
That's right.
Talk a little bit about what your situation is now and where you would like to be.
I'm hoping to retire in about 2 years, and I have a pension that I think will be around $38,000 a year. And I own a condo, and I expect to take away maybe $200,000 to $225,000 once I sell it. And so my question is, how much of that money can I reasonably invest in a new house in Michigan?
That's a good question. And Nancy, I just want to point out, so you said you want to retire in 2 years. You're going to be a young retiree because you're 59.
That's right.
Yeah. So that's, Greg, that's something to take in consideration, right?
Absolutely. I think one of the biggest variables in the question that's being asked, which is, you know, how much can I afford to put down on the home? And probably the subsequent question would be, you know, how much is left and how much can I take from my portfolio to supplement my Social Security and pension?
Right.
And a big variable in that discussion is, how long will you live?
Listen, that's just a small question, Greg. That's a big question, Nancy, right? How long are you going to live?
Well, people in my family tend to live a long time, but, you know, it's not to say I necessarily will.
Right. I think life expectancy and family history is a good indication. It's not perfect. A lot of people focus on the stock market, inflation, taxes, so many variables. But reality is that this life expectancy issue, that last 10 years of life that we may or may not expect, is one of the most difficult parts of the equation that we as investment advisors have to think about when we're asked this question.
Right.
And it's an answer that we don't have.
Right. I know. I mean, because I could be in good health or not.
And sometimes, Greg, especially now that we're having so many advancements in medicine, a lot of us, of course, are just living longer. And for women in particular, the average lifespan is now somewhere around 82 and 84. So Nancy, we can just expect that you're going to spend at least 20 plus years in retirement. Does buying a home make sense right now?
You know, I think probably, you know, it's a qualitative issue as to the kind of place you want to live, but buying a home may make sense. I think owning a home is often a good investment over a long period of time, you know, unlike buying things like televisions and automobiles,
right,
which depreciate. We do expect over a long period for a home to appreciate. A lot of times when we think about retirees buying homes where they might need the money, the equity that's in the home, it wouldn't be completely off the table, the idea of selling the home somewhere later in life, living there for 15, 20 years. And if there came a time where you needed the money that was in the home to live on, you could at some point downsize and possibly use those resources to then go and rent.
And you're looking to, and Nancy, you're looking to make a really smart move. You're moving from one of the most expensive cities in the nation, San Francisco, to Ann Arbor, Michigan, which, you know, I have some family out there, and I can tell you it's a lot cheaper to live out there.
Yeah.
Your pension is about $38,000 a year. So, Greg, what does she need to think about in terms of how much home to buy and then how much she'll need in addition to that pension to withdraw?
So one question, Nancy, is, do you have an idea of what your living expenses are?
They're outrageous here in San Francisco. I mean, I make close to $80,000 a year, a huge portion of which goes to taxes and expenses. And basically, I don't have savings. I was able to do this as a part of a couple, but as a single person here in San Francisco, you know, anytime something happens, like the roof needs replacing or the dog needs surgery, you know, things go on the credit card.
Do you have other resources available to you other than the proceeds from the sale of the home?
Well, I own a car. I have a very small IRA that I inherited from my mother that's about $17,000.
But your pension's about $38,000, which could be manageable, Greg, in Michigan. And you're going to get around $225,000, you say, from the sale of the condo.
Right.
So is a lot of this, and Nancy, I would suspect, is her living expenses may change so drastically. Is it worthwhile for Nancy to really do some research and boil down her monthly expenses in Michigan?
Yeah, it might not be a bad idea to even consider moving there and renting for a year. Get a feel for the area, what your expenses are, spend a little time there, make sure you feel committed, and then maybe a year later considering buying something. But if you think your Social Security and pension, which eventually with Social Security cumulatively with your pension, it's probably going to be something of north of $50,000 a year.
Right.
And it's, if you think you could potentially live on that, which I think is not very different than the after-tax income you're living on now in San Francisco.
Right.
If that's possible, then I think a good decent amount of the proceeds from the 200 some odd thousand you mentioned could be used for a new home.
Well, in Ann Arbor, probably 150,000, but in the outlying areas, definitely less.
Yeah. So, Nancy, what do you think about of going there and living and renting for a while? Because I think that that's really good advice for a lot of people who are looking to retire in a new place. That's a very big difference from what you're used to.
I do think that's a good idea.
Nancy, thank you so much for calling.
Good luck, Nancy.
Okay, thank you.
And Greg, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I'm happy to be here.
Greg Fisher is a CFP and the founder and chief investment officer of Gerstein Fisher. If you have a question for us here at Marketplace Money and you'd like to come on and talk to us, go to marketplacemoney.org and click on Ask Carmen. Up next, family lessons about money.
The thing my parents have in common is that they're both, and I use this word in a very positive way, they're both hustlers. They will both figure out what they need to do to make the money they need, and also to make the money they need and the money that they want to have a good time. And I think they pass that down on to me.
And who says you can't have fun with FICO? We take your credit questions at lightning speed, coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich. You know, our family is where we learned our first lessons about money. And each of us has certainly had a different education. It's Family Money 101. This week, an open mic for a stand-up comedian.
My name is Debbie Kamau Bell. I'm a stand-up comedian. When you start doing stand-up comedy, it's really quite impossible to make a living from it. First of all, most shows you do when you start, you're not getting paid anything. You have to get into it for the love, and then you have to continue to love it because there will be peaks and valleys. Sometimes you have to take sort of other jobs and other opportunities that you don't necessarily want just to keep piecing it together. I grew up mostly with my mom. My parents were separated, living with my mom, and I'd go visit my dad's in the summer in Alabama. The thing my parents have in common is that they're both, and I use this word in a very positive way, they're both hustlers. They will both figure out what they need to do to make the money they need, and also to make the money they need and the money that they want to have a good time. And I think they pass that down on to me. When I was a kid, my mom worked at textbook companies, had like a pension. I think the big thing that I learned from my mom is don't be too big-headed to take a job. Even if you're doing something that's DIY, sometimes you have to take sort of other jobs and other opportunities that you don't necessarily want just to keep piecing it together. And at some point, she decided that she was doing all this work for somebody else. And she's like, if I'm going to work this hard, I want to work for myself and create something I want to create. And we moved to Chicago, and she started self-publishing her own books of famous African-American quotations called Famous Black Quotations. She, at that point, worked all those hours, but on her own project. And so from her, I learned you can't expect to, like, not have a regular job, and it's going to get easier. It actually gets a lot harder. When I was a kid, my dad was really just sort of professionally semi-employed, I guess is how I would put it. He had a lot of little jobs, but no real big job. My dad was probably more like I am now, where he was sort of putting it together piece by piece. But then at some point, he clearly decided that he needed to make money. And at like 40 years old, he went to the bank and became a teller. And he worked his way up to bank manager, and then he met a guy and started selling insurance. And so clearly at some point decided that one of the measures in life was how much you can sort of acquire. And then I think now he's at the point of how much you can leave behind for the next generation, making sure that you're saving enough money and that you have all the insurances that are available to you. It didn't make sense to me when my dad talked about it, but I think also at the time I was maybe 13 and I didn't have a wife and a child. So I think, you know, when you get married and have a kid, suddenly that stuff starts to make more sense. You know, I mean, she's 2.5, so we haven't really had the saving conversation yet. But the goal is to sort of building on what my parents taught me is that money is a real thing. You have to respect it and you have to have it to live in the world. But don't get so focused on it that you also don't use the money to do the things you want to do.
Yeah, she may be two, but that college will come really fast. Send us your own lessons in family finance. Tweet us at Live Money. Here at Marketplace Money, we get a lot more questions than we can answer, but we love answering them. And we must. That's why we've created the Lightning Round. 5 minutes of super fun personal finance. And for the start of 2014, we're going to tackle all your questions about credit cards. My partner in credit, not crime, this time around is Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech. He's going to keep me honest. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Carmen. Okay, all right. You have 5 minutes. Ready? Go. Our first question comes from Melanie in Los Angeles, who sent this email. She has some credit cards that she hasn't used since 2001. If she calls and cancels them, what will that do to her FICO score?
She'll get dinged. She'll get dinged. She'll lose some points. Okay. And here's why. Simply because two things. One, it won't be on her report as active, right? And two, she won't have access to that credit. So she's carrying a balance on anything else.
Okay.
She'll basically have a higher, debt utilization ratio.
Ooh, deadly.
Did you follow with that one? Basically, if she's carrying a balance of $5,000 and she has open 4 cards with a total of $50,000, her debt ratio is very small. If she closes a couple of those, all of a sudden that percentage gets bigger. So I would say this, Melanie, use those cards and then just keep them in rotation in your wallet.
So don't go for the dings.
It's not so much about the dings as access to the credit. You want to keep open credit lines.
All right. So here's another wrinkle to that question from Alex. He's in Austin, Texas. He wants to know, is it smart to let your credit score die? And I mean, pay all your debts, car note and everything. Wait those months until your FICO vanishes. If you are up to the challenge of finding a manual underwriting company for your mortgage and save cash for everything you want to buy. Wow, this is deadly.
Alex. Credit scores don't die.
They go away.
They do not die. They just shrink and shrivel. Listen, they don't die until you die. Not to get all macabre, but it's absolutely true. Those credit scores will always be in existence as long as you're around on this planet. So here's the thing. What he's really asking here is, can I use an alternative way of borrowing money? Alex, I would really prefer that you make sure that you pay your debts on time every time, but you just make sure that you have your credit score and it's in really good shape. I'm not exactly sure why you want to go to alternative credit because, frankly, if you're talking about your mortgage, which are low interest rates right now, why? Why, Alex? Why?
Why die?
Let your credit score live. It's meant okay. to live.
Here's another email from Laura in Berkeley. This also has to do with FICO. She pays her balance off monthly, and when she got her free credit card score report, she was shocked to learn that her score wasn't as high as she thought. One of the explanations was that her credit balance was too high compared to the limit on the card. Is that fair?
Is life fair, Laura?
Nope.
No. Life is not fair. Credit scoring is just what it is, my girl. Now, listen, Laura, going back to Melanie, the first question, Ben.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Same thing here. It's she's got too much. She's using too much of her credit.
Aha.
So she's got a balance of $10,000 and she only has two cards with a combined limit of 20. She's using 50% of the credit available to her. One third of your FICO scores is made up of how much debt you're actually using. Uh-huh. The only way to get that FICO score up is to lower the amount of debt that you have outstanding.
Aha. Okay, we're getting down to the wire. Rosemary sent this in from Suffolk, Virginia. She asks, how can her husband build his credit score? He doesn't want to kill it. He wants to build it. He moved from Sweden. He has no debt. He owns his home in Sweden. He has credit cards from banks in Sweden, but he's unable to get a credit card from other banks except USAA banks. USAA is where we both have accounts. She says, help. Can you help her?
Yes, Rosemary, here's the thing. Like Lazarus, you must rise and make his credit alive and live.
It lives.
It lives.
His credit lives.
Franken credit. Here's okay. what he needs to do. If you do not have credit history, whether you are not American citizen or do not have access to credit or okay. American credit, you need to get a secured card. Two things you could do. Get a secured card that reports to the credit reporting agencies. You put money down as a security deposit. Then you use it like a credit card.
Okay.
Then you actually get loaned money. Or with his wife, Rosemary, he can open a joint card. The two of them can open it together and use the credit wisely.
Together.
Make it live.
Carmen, our time is up. You did amazing. Four questions answered well, as always, Carmen. Nicely done.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you for keeping me honest here. And next time, we're going to even get to even more of your questions here on Marketplace Money's Lightning Round. If you have a question that you want us to tackle, head over to MarketplaceMoney.org and click on Ask Carmen. So goes your credit. So goes your life. So make sure you tune in 2 weeks. We're going to devote an entire show to credit, from scores to interest rates, digging out of debt to building up your borrowing. Send us your questions, or even better, tell us what you're doing right. Head over to MarketplaceMoney.org and click on Ask Carmen. So this new year means new rules for buying a home. Now, of course, only if you borrow, as most of us do. Here to shed some light on what to expect when it comes to mortgages in 2014 is Elise Glink. She's a real estate specialist and author of 100 Questions Every First-Time Homebuyer Should Ask. Welcome, Elise.
Nice to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So here's the thing. You know, we have these new rules for our mortgages. And Elizabeth Warren, the senator, actually said, and I quote, that these new mortgage laws, they are there to protect consumers to avoid being trapped and tricked. What is this really about?
Well, for years, we've had predatory lending where lenders would come in and charge you huge amounts of money. I'm still hearing from consumers who are carrying mortgages with 10% plus interest rates. And people got locked into predatory loans, but they also got locked into loans that were not appropriate for them. So the way that the mortgage industry used to work, and no longer works this way, but it used to work that the mortgage broker that you would go to would get paid by you because you'd pay points and fees to get the loan, and they get paid by the end lender they were going to sell it to. And there was something called a fee service premium where they would get paid more to steer you into a bad loan. So it was lousy all the way around.
Oh, gosh, there's that incentive. some of the changes are pretty substantial and will really change how a lot of buyers buy this year. Can you give me a quick run through of, like, let's say the top three changes that you think are going to impact borrowers this year?
Absolutely. The first is that you have to be able to repay your loan. I mean, this is just kind of out of the blue, but people were getting loans that they had absolutely no hope in anything of being able to repay. You would get somebody who had a $50,000 a year income, and they would be sold a $500,000 loan. And they would do it based on qualifying by the teaser rate, which might be 0% or 1%, but it wasn't the real cost of the loan. That's all been outlawed. We've also seen negative amortization loans be outlawed. These are loans where whatever you were paying didn't even cover the real cost of paying or servicing the loan, and the extra amount got added on to the loan. So if you started with a $100,000 loan, in 5 years your loan might be $110,000. So instead of building equity, you had negative equity. That's been outlawed as well. The one I want to tell you about now is something called a no-doc loan. People got these all the time. You didn't have to actually verify the income. You didn't have to prove what you were earning. And people got no-doc or stated income loans all the time. A lot of those loans went bad in the housing crisis. Those are also outlawed. So there are all kinds of rules that have now been put into place very specifically to keep people from getting loans that they truly can't afford, because this is one of the problems that we've seen over the last 7 years.
And then what else can we expect in terms of new rules for mortgages and borrowing down the road? Because a lot of the CFPB is doing is great to start. It seems very encompassing. But, you know, lenders have just an interesting way of creating new products that lead us down another path that they would like. So is it kind of a little bit of a whack-a-mole from this point on?
You know, I don't know. I think you could say that about almost anything. There will always be creative financing techniques. Back in the early 90s, lenders were doing this for commercial property loans, very creative. And then somebody said, hey, why don't we do that for residential loans? And then mortgage interest rates started coming down. And then it was a free-for-all in the 90s and the 2000s. And then we ended up where we ended up. So I think that lenders will always be creative because they're in the business of lending money. But I think what you're going to see, and it's true that lenders are a little concerned about this, you know, I think it will be harder for some people to qualify. If you're self-employed, it's already hard to qualify, but it's going to be even harder. If you have a cash business and you have a lot of expenses that come out of it, but, you know, so your income is showing to be less than it actually is, on your federal income tax forms, for example, real estate investors face this all the time because they get to depreciate their business. And so if you depreciate buildings, then it reduces your amount of taxes that you pay by reducing your income. But it's not truly representative of the cash you have coming into your life. And so those people may find it harder to borrow. So there is going to be a segment of people who are going to have trouble. But I think the vast majority of Americans are going to be able to go and get paperwork that they understand for the first time. Somebody's going to hand you an 80-page loan document. Hopefully you're going to be able to understand it. And so I'm for anything that protects consumers and helps them understand a little bit more about the single biggest purchase they're ever going to make in their whole life.
Sounds really good to me. Elise, thanks so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Elise Glink is a real estate specialist and author of the book 100 Questions Every First-Time Homebuyer Should Ask. If you have a question about home ownership and mortgages, send them in. Go to marketplacemoney.org. Really hard to get your financial house in order if you're not sure where home is going to be for the next couple of years. But that doesn't mean you can't plan for the future bit by bit. That brings us to our voicemail of the week.
Hello, Carmen. My name is Winnie. I really enjoy the show. I'm an international graduate student. I have 5 figures in my bank account. Part of the reason is that I have the Graduate Assistantship Award from the university so that I don't have to pay for the tuition, and I have monthly stipend from the university. Another thing is that my fiancé, who's working in a Wall Street company, also have 5 figures in his bank account. We plan to stay here in the United States for a few years, and we don't know what to do with the money we have right now, because we will see how the life goes in New York. and then decide whether we will stay here longer, like 10 years or 20 years, or go back to a country we came from. So we don't know what to invest in.
Well, Winnie, here's the thing. There's a lot of we're not sure, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, but you want to keep your money flexible. If you're thinking about long-term investing, one thing to keep in mind is that you can open a retirement account, an IRA. A traditional IRA has a lot more flexibility when it comes to saving if you are not an American. But here's the thing. You want to cash that out in retirement. If you take it before retirement, the best way tax-wise to get access to that money is to actually move first into your country of origin, as you mentioned, and then have access to the money in terms of taxes. But it is very complicated and difficult to think of when you have a 5 to 10 year outlook. You actually don't want to risk a lot of money if you're only looking at 5 to 10 years. So don't feel bad about having that money in cash. Look for some higher yield CDs maybe and some money markets. Just hold on tight and reassess your situation every year, but don't put that money in anything risky or anything that's going to tie it up too tight until you know where you're going to stay.
Please leave a message after the tone.
So you have a money question? Record it. I love to hear your voices. Leave me a message by heading to marketplacemoney.org. Press the record audio button under Ask Carmen. And don't forget to leave your name and where you're from so I can have you on air. That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, the rules of thumb for your retirement. What are they? And when is it right to break those rules? Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali, Raghu Manavalan, Candice Manriquez, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. Ravi Carmen is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich. Remember, always check with your financial pro before you make any big money decisions. Thanks for listening, and let's talk soon.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.